Okay, we'll start. We just got in from Hong Kong very late last night, and I don't know where I am. Okay. So I apologize. All right, in advance. I think first I wanted to say that but we're trying to find some programs in Phoenix also in the fall, just to get it used to happening, you know. And then I'm thinking there would be like three different kinds of things going on in Phoenix. One would be, you know, when I'm around, maybe every weekend, some kind of, like Dharma teaching. And then I was thinking maybe two or three different things. One that, I mean, obviously I think we have to continue this maybe. And then maybe some exotic tantric thing, which I don't know what yet. And then I had this really clear vision to teach all of Nampa Lakto, liberation in the hands of your, liberation in the palm of your hands. Usually I don't teach things that have already been translated, but I felt like it's a teaching that I was given three times through by Rinpoche over 25 years. And also it's like, I was sitting around with some friends, some close friends, having a table, and people said, "What's your favorite book of all time?" You know. And then when it came my turn, I was thinking, Namdo Lakchang is my favorite book of all time. I think it's the greatest, maybe the greatest book ever written in this world, you know. So I think it would be a nice, somehow it would be nice to go through a whole long rim. And it's a special one because it's about, I don't know, it's 800 pages or something, and it's very, very, I don't know. It was given as an oral teaching, not to the monks, but to the people in Lhasa. And Pabongkor Rinpoche, I heard he got in trouble for doing it. But it's full of very beautiful stories and, you know, very beautiful teachings. And I thought that if people couldn't make it to all of them, and they just, it's something you could drop in on, and, you know, if it went on for like 5 years, you could drop in for a weekend and still, you would still get the eight kinds of patience or something like that, you know. And then I was thinking to do some 10-day intensives, like more, keep going like 3-4 times a year. We used to do at the FPMT centers. Do you remember? And like Vajrapani and LMB and, what's that one in Bodh Gaya? Root Institute. But we used to do like an ACI course, two classes on Saturday, two classes on Sunday, Tuesday and Thursday night, which was sort of optional for people who were, you know, out of town, and then four classes on the following weekend. So that's 10 classes in 10 days. And it's 2 weekends if you got to work between. If you're working nearby, you can still catch all 10. If you're working far away, you get 8 out of 10. And something like that. So I was thinking that that would be something I'd like to try in Phoenix, you know? So like we, you know, like a regular weekend thing, and then 10-day intensives, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. Say like that, you know? And then the rest of the time would probably be a lot of touring, because we're planning to release 10 DCI courses over the next 5 years. So in maybe 10 or 15 major cities in the world. So we're, and then keep going back to the same cities for 5 years and repeat courses there. So but I'll try to give you dates. And people are looking for a place in Phoenix. I had this vision of of like a mission style building, like adobe and Spanish, what do you call it? Mission architecture with the tiles and the arches and then a garden and that it's all run down and it's some very old building and, you know, nobody wants it and it's on the edge of an Hispanic neighborhood. So I just keep seeing this thing. So we have to find that. Kat was looking. She found something on the Gila Reservation or something like that. It's too far away, I think. I think it's in Phoenix somewhere. And then I think we end up, it ends up a community center also for the local people. And we help, you know, poor people learn English and learn yoga and meditation and like that. And but then middle class people can come from their barrio over sometimes, you know, like that. I just see something like that. And then maybe a business school, a separate business school up in North Phoenix where all the reputable universities are, that would have mostly people from Asia, maybe foreign students there, a lot of foreign students. There's over 500,000 foreign students in American universities at any given time. And there are a lot of people we meet in Asia who would like to come and do a business course here. So I'm thinking about that's all the things I'm thinking about. So we'll continue with this. We'll have one more course here. And then we'll keep going with it. Okay. All right, so we've been discussing the question of we've been discussing this question for a long time. You think that to see emptiness directly, you would have to have some special kind of good karma, right? I mean, you would. And I, in my early years of my study in New Jersey, I used to think, it must be bodhicitta, you know? Like, it must be that you have to have ultimate love before you can see emptiness directly, because maybe that's the karma you need. You know, that's the amount of karma you need to see emptiness directly. So I used to play with that idea, and I used to worry about that a lot. And then what this text is saying, and what the official party line is that people on a lower track, people on the Hinayana, can still see emptiness directly. And so these are people who supposedly don't have bodhicitta, right? They don't have ultimate love. So then there becomes a question, you know, how can they see emptiness directly? First of all, they don't have this ultimate love, which, by the way, is mentioned in the Abhidhamma Kosha, but there's not much teaching on it. So they don't have that. Then the question becomes, well, do they have full-fledged teachings on emptiness? You know, like, if you claim that Hinayana people can see emptiness without ultimate love, without needing that much karma, they must be getting some really good teachings on emptiness. It must be very high level teachings about emptiness. But then there are all these, you know, generally we say that the lower schools can't describe emptiness correctly, right? And they never really understand emptiness. And they have all these weird, all the lower Mahamudra, right, flavors that we've enunciated in that six Mahamudras. They are all supposedly belong to other schools, right? Lower schools. I think how many, like the first two or the first three are lower schools, right? So are Hinayana schools. So how can they see emptiness? How can you say they see emptiness directly if they never get a teaching on it, right? So if they never hear a correct teaching on emptiness, if there doesn't exist in Hinayana a correct teaching on emptiness, how can you claim that they see emptiness directly, even without bodhicitta, even without that extreme karma, right? And then you get into these discussions like, well, special people get a lower teaching on a lower kind of emptiness, and then they just work really hard at that, and suddenly they pop into a understanding of a higher kind of emptiness. You know, I mean, that's where your thinking tends to go, you know. They must get lower teachings on emptiness, and then they kind of work hard and they're nice people, and then they pop into some higher understanding emptiness that even their teachers can't explain. Okay? Like that. I mean, you would think that, right? It would seem to be like that. That seems to be the only explanation. Because the big claim is what? They are arhats. That it's possible to achieve arhat, the level of an arhat, in on the lower path, right? And then we're going to teach Lama Chöpa, right? That's the big subject. The last tantric class, the last course is devoted to Lama Chöpa. Lama Chöpa means the offering to lamas. And it's basically the ultimate ritual of guru devotion, right? So we thought, Lama Christine and I thought that, you know, this being the end of the tantric series, 18 courses, that it should be, I mean, partner practice should be next to last. And in guru devotion, which in many cases is another form of partner practice, right, would be the last course, right? And then, so I'm translating all these materials for that class, and there came a debate in it, and there's a debate that this ritual is actually Anuttara Tantra, okay? That this Guru Yoga ritual, the first Panchen Lama and the commentators state that this particular way of worshipping your teacher is the highest Tantra system there is. You know, so then there you're supposed to be visualizing your lama, and there are supposed to be like circles of high beings around your lama who end up being your lama. So first you see your lama, then you see your other direct teachers in this life, then around them, right, working out, and then you see teachers of the lineage, and only then you see Buddhas. Okay, they are less important than the others, right? And then you see bodhisattvas, and then you see tantric deities, and then you see protectors, dharma protectors, and then all this stuff. And then all the commentators stop and they say, well, what happened to the arhats? You know, where are the arhats? Especially the listeners and the self-made Buddhas, you know? And then some commentators say, well, this is Anuttara Yoga. There aren't any, you know? They are lower school. They don't even have bodhicitta. They don't deserve to be in the group, you know, of all these people that you're going to make these offerings to. So, but even in the Anuttara Tantric system, the highest system of all Buddhism, they say there are people who have eliminated their negative feelings forever because they saw emptiness directly, right? So how can they do that if they never get a teaching on it, right? And then the question arises, if they do get a teaching, if in the Hinayana scriptures emptiness is taught correctly, the highest form of emptiness, then why teach Mahayana? Then what's the difference between Mahayana and Hinayana? You know, what distinguishes them? Why teach Mahayana if the main difference is a higher kind of presentation on emptiness, right? So this is where we were, okay? That's a review of where we were, and it's a good question, you know. In my mind, when I was younger, I used to struggle with the question of how could you ever see emptiness directly without a high attainment of love, right? And then here the question is also, how can you see ultimate or the highest form of emptiness directly and still be on the lower track, okay? And then lower tracks, as you know, are defined in two different ways. Some people say a lower track means no teachings on bodhicitta, no teachings on love, bodhisattva's activities. And then some say, no, they are defined by lower teaching on emptiness. But either way, it would seem suspect that a person could get rid of all of their negativities on a lower path. Okay? That's where we are. That's where the debate is. Okay? Our position most recently has been a full form of emptiness is taught in the Hinayana scriptures. Okay? We took that position. We gave some scriptural proofs for that. We gave some logical proofs for that, meaning that so many sources say that you can become an arhat in a lower path that it means that they must see highest emptiness directly, okay? Highest emptiness is a little bit of a misnomer, right? The other ones aren't really emptiness, okay? All right. So we're at the point in the text where they get to come back. Okay, they get. We try to prove to them that people on a lower track can see emptiness directly, and they use that to remove their negative emotions forever. Okay, and then we try to prove that to them with scripture and with logic, and then now they get a chance to come back to us and say, we don't think so. All right. Mm-hmm. And I think the most important thing in your mind, which is worth saying again, is why, and I think it's a very serious weakness of many presentations in the modern day on emptiness, right? And I think at Diamond Mountain we bridge that problem. But the question being, why does the direct perception of emptiness free you from negative emotions forever? You know, what is it about the direct perception of emptiness that can in time, eliminate all of your anger, all of your jealousy, you know, all of your desire? Why would the direct perception of emptiness do that? Because that's the selling point for the direct perception of emptiness. Okay, the immediate selling point is that if you see emptiness directly, very soon you will overcome your negative emotions forever. Okay, so. How does that work exactly, right? And then you get some weird explanations. People say if you see emptiness directly, then when you get angry, you stare at it and it dissolves somehow. You know, now I mean you hear that kind of stuff. You know, you have desire for a boy, and then you stare at him and his parts until you can't see the boy anymore, and then you don't feel desire. No, I was taught that in Dharamsala when I started. This is what people say, you know. And so let's review a little bit about why seeing emptiness directly would, what kind of effect would that have on your negative emotions, right? Because that's, happiness would be to see that emptiness directly and then wear down your negative emotions until they're gone, and then you would be happy all the time, right? Mm. So we just had a beautiful time in Hong Kong. The last night in Hong Kong, the local Dharma people said, would you just teach a private class? You know, not like lots of people. Would you just teach a private class for our members? You know, and I was like, yeah, I feel like that. That would be fun. You know, so we just did, we were in a small room like half this size, and like 50 people came. And they said, would you teach like an advanced class about emptiness? You know? So I was like, that sounds fun to me. You know, instead of when a lot of people come, then you can't really talk about anything very complicated because they'll leave at the break. You know, you have to keep going over the pen over and over and the dog and everything. And it's like, I don't know. It's like Joni Mitchell used to complain that people asked her to sing the songs from her second album 40 years later, every night. And she's like, don't you want to hear anything else that I ever did, you know? And I'm like, no, just sing us, what is it? I love the life. Clouds, yeah, just sing Clouds, you know? So I've been singing that since I was 18, you know? I did some jazz pieces for 10 years. Would you like to hear something else? And they're like, no. And so sometimes you're just starting to feel like that on tours, you know? So I was kind of feeling like hungry to teach a real class, you know? And here it's fun because we just keep going through new stuff, you know? So then, you know, we talked about Chi Chen Dao. We talked about how the mind makes mental images and how... And we went very beautifully. It was really beautiful. We were supposed to take a break, and we all decided not to take a break. And everybody, the air conditioner broke. That was the only break we had. And then it was like everybody was pouring in sweat. And then a car alarm went off outside. All these demons were trying to stop it. And then suddenly we just all got into it. And all these people, I don't know why, but they... Just, there was a magical night in Hong Kong, you know, and all these people, because I'm trying to explain that the name of the talk was A and Da. The name of the talk was A and Da. So they don't have A and Da, right, in Chinese. So, you know, you're speaking about ANBAD to a group of 50 Chinese people who don't have an ANBAD in their language, you know. And then, but it was very beautiful, and it something magical happened, you know. And we really went very deep, you know. So the basic premise that night was, instead of going at emptiness with a pen, or instead of going at emptiness, I like to use an aspirin nowadays. That works pretty well. We used it a lot this last time because people had already heard about the pen. And then we decided to try to go at it like the difference between, I was standing there and I had a clock near me, right? They were hoping I would end on time, and which never happens, right? And I held up the clock, you know, and I said, what's the difference between clock and the clock, right? What's the difference between clock and the clock, you know? So you have to think about that for a second. Okay, what's the difference between clock and the real? What's the difference between clock and the clock, right? And so then it comes into your, I mean, you have to think a lot about it, okay? But generally speaking, easily speaking, clock is an idea, right? Like clock with the quotation marks, right? Quote clock. You know, when you go like this and you say quote clock, and you use this mudra, this American mudra, you know, quote clock. You know, he's my boyfriend, and he was quote loyal. You know? So you're referring to an idea, right? Like you're referring to an ideal in your mind, right? It's used a lot in sarcasm, right? Clock is an ideal, right? Jung called it an archetype, right? In Tibetan it's called a qi, right? Like a dun qi or a da qi. It's the perfect clock in your mind, right? And then you go around, I mean, the conventional wisdom says that you have all these ideal pictures in your, like, perfect things in your mind. Like when you were 3 years old, when you were in the kitchen, your mother pointed to the clock in the kitchen, and she said, clock, Lizette, clock. You know, and you said, quack. You know, and then, you learned your first clock in this life, right? So that's how we view it. And then she yelled, quack, quack, and you yelled back, quack. And then for the rest of your life, you know, in conventional terms, that clock in your mother's kitchen became your qi. It became your ideal clock in your mind, right? And that causes its own problems when you get married and stuff like that. And you have different things in someone else's house, and they don't quite look like the clock that you know, there's a debate about what a big spoon is. You know, because you have, your mom said what a big spoon was, and that's your qi. That's your ideal of a big spoon. And then there gets to be debates later in your life about what, you know, hand me a big spoon. You know, and you can get weird things coming. Okay, so there's a qi in your mind, right? And in worldly terms, you got it when your mom explained to you what a clock was. And you have this perfect picture in your mind of a clock. Clock. That's clock for Lizette. Mom's clock in the kitchen when I was 3. That's clock. And then, you know, in conventional terms, every time, how do we recognize objects, you see? When somebody holds up a clock and you recognize it, how does that happen? You see? How do you know that's a clock? And that's a big subject of the logic scriptures. Which you got course 13, that's all you ever got, okay? Yingbo's working on like a 600-page commentary by Kedujin, which is very, very beautiful. But a lot of the logic scriptures are actually meant to address a very fundamental question about what is an ideal object in your mind? What is a perfect clock in your mind? And how do you recognize clocks when you see them? What happens in your mind when you see a clock, you see? Because in all Madhyamika schools, an understanding of that is considered the doorway to seeing emptiness directly, you see? And it would be weird. It's a weird idea to think that somebody who just got out of Abhidharma, they're like a lower evolutionary form, right? Like they're like a troglodyte that crawled up on the beach, you know? Like they just got out of Abhidharma, primordial ocean, right? And they're crawling up on this rock. with no trees, nothing, just rock. And it's the first, shrimp. So I said, there's this really funny thing in Taiwan. I was making jokes about sotongs, and people were roaring, you know, and I was like, I would say, you know, a person who doesn't understand anything is there at sotong, you know. And they started roaring. I said, God, I'm really clever tonight, you know. And then afterwards somebody told me, Bishla, sotong in Taiwan, in Chinese, means squid. You know? And they thought you were making a joke about squids, you know. And that's why you were so good tonight. But anyway, so it's a, you know, the book that Kikuchi wrote about logic, he spends the first 20 pages defending the study of logic. You know, why do you have to study logic, you know? And then he says something like, I forget, he goes off on criticizing people who think logic is dumb, or logic is irrelevant, or logic is dry. And he says, you know, trying to see emptiness without logic is like saying you're starving but you don't like food. You know, and he goes off, or that you want to build a steps up to your new retreat cabin, and somebody says, are you going to use cement or rocks? And you say, bubbles. You know, like that. You know, he says, it's as stupid to say, I'm not interested in logic, but I want to see emptiness. You know, he's saying it's like the stairway, you know, to get there. So why? Because what we didn't get into in Course 13, and we can get into in the coming years, you know, is even you three-year people, we can see you in the fourth year, and you can, we'll probably be 25 pages into it by then. So don't get worried, okay? I mean, we go so slow, right? It doesn't, like I haven't even touched the text tonight yet. And I do that every week. So don't worry about that. I think a three-year retreat is good, and then you, we'll be to the point of the subject by the time you get out. So there's a, the meat of the of so-called logic scriptures, it's really the scriptures on perception. It's the study of perception. So how do you know a clock? When you look at a clock, how do you know it's a clock? Right? And then, you know, general, what do you call it? Common wisdom, right? Is that what they call it?
Common sense.
Common, conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom says that the mind, you know, I hold a clock up in front of you, and your mind is like a huge, like I always think of Princeton Library. Princeton Library, when I was there, had 5 million books in it, and they kept adding stories down. They kept going down and down deeper. It went like 7, 8, 9 stories into the ground, and then somebody would donate another 10,000 books, and they'd have to dig another story down. And I always think of Princeton Library, because you couldn't find anything there. And you could get lost in there and just never come back up, you know. And it happened to me a lot. And I'll tell you an irrelevant story, but my friend will like it. So we had a girl with us who was sort of, I don't know how to say, mischievous. And she said, I bet I could stand up on the table down there on the 7th floor down and take off all my, do a striptease on the table and nobody will notice. You know? And she just about did it. But anyway, your mind is like a, your mind is like a Princeton Library. You know, seven floors down, 5 million volumes. Think of each volume as an ideal picture of something. Like the clock. The clock from Lizette's mom's kitchen when she was 3 years old is down on the fourth floor in the sixth row on the fourth shelf. It's the sixth mental image down. And she has all these images in her mind, stored in her mind. It has to be, right? If you don't believe in past lives and all that, it has to be that your mind is somehow storing ideal images, right? And then someone holds a clock up, and your mind flips through, your mind goes through every book in the library, you know? The South Tramvika says your mind eliminates every other book to get to the clock. Okay, which is sort of an amazing thing, because I hold it up and within a millisecond you recognize it, right? So how does your mind do that? You know, I mean, the South Tramvika says your mind actually goes through 5 million mental images in the time it takes me to hold up the watch,
a car. And then it finds banana, it compares banana to the thing, nope, not that one. And then it finds, a cactus, and it, nope, not a cactus. And then it finds, a cake from my last birthday, nope, not that. And then it gets the clock, and supposedly this happens, if a clock exists out there, right, already, and the way you recognize a clock is conventional, what conventional wisdom says, then your mind goes through 5 million possible candidates and eliminates them to come to clock. That's like unbelievable. Okay? And then in the higher schools, they're still talking about clock. They're still talking clock. Why are we talking about clock? We're trying to see why you get rid of your anger and your jealousy and your desire when you see emptiness there. Okay, that was the point, right? He went off on this long thing about Hong Kong, and then he went to the Princeton Library, okay, and then that girl. So, what does the higher school say? Okay, higher school says you've had clock in your mind for beginning this time. You've had clock forever, and then maybe you gave a clock to someone recently, meaning the last 5,000 lives or so. You gave a clock to someone, right? And then that put a seed in your mind. Karmic seed, right? The big question that you guys should be interested in, the one that you should like spend a lot of time on, is like, which the scriptures don't spend a lot of time on, but you can find it. It's like the Princeton Library. You can find it. But just how does a seed ripen? How does a karmic seed ripen? You see, what happens when a seed in your mind ripens? Okay, I understand I gave a clock 5,000 lives ago, and I put a seed for a clock in my mind. And then there was a potential, there was some kind of energy in my mind. I understand that. And then, the right conditions happened. I was with my mom. We needed to check how long the cake would take, right, to finish in the oven. And she, in the kitchen, and she pointed to the thing and said, clock. And then according to the high school, there's no clock out there, right? There's suddenly, in conjunction with another karma of cooking a cake with your mom, there ripens the seed for the perception of a clock, which happened to be necessary at the time of cooking the cake. So there was a karma for the fulfillment of necessity. There was a karma for the baking of a cake. And there was a karma for you to see a clock. But you don't see a clock, you're making a clock, right? Your mind is making a clock at the moment that you needed it, which is all about having supplied other people with needs when they needed it, and not 15 minutes later. Okay? Like that. The clock was there when your mom turned around, because your mind projected the clock at that moment, because you had helped somebody at an opportune moment before, when they needed a clock, okay? Like right now, I guess you might have. You didn't get it. Well, okay, I have my computer.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, see, there's the thought. Alright. So, really crucial question for you guys. Really, really important question for you guys is, just how is it that a karmic seed ripens in the mind? What happens when a karmic seed ripens, right? And it opens, at the proper time, due to conditions, right? Which for negative karmas and dirty good karmas, the fertilizer is your misunderstanding, right? The karma could never open if you weren't misunderstanding. If you were not actively misunderstanding the world, the karmas couldn't open, okay? Like when you're in the direct perception of emptiness, no other karma can open because you are understanding perfectly. If we were understanding perfectly all the time, no other karma seeds could open. See, it's not possible. Okay, so right conditions of our ignorance, then how does the karma for a clock open? How does the seed open? What happens? Like that millisecond, what's happening in your mind is very beautiful. I think you have to think of the back of your head as like a bunch of dirt, like flat. It starts, there's a terrace up here, okay? And, there's a little flat area about an inch in, and there's some dirt there, and it's clear, okay? It's not like dirt, it's like clear, it's like water. And then up out of the water pops this image, okay, of a clock. Out of billions and billions of seeds, you just had an image of a clock pop up, okay? Each of us did, just now. Okay, you had an image of a clock open. That image was planted when you offered someone a clock who needed one in the past, probably. Maybe you were trying to get somebody to class on time, something like that. And you were waving your clock at them, or something like that. No, of course not you guys, because you're on time. But, you know, something like that. Like, if at least the karma would be planted by something like that. Like, I mean, we're all like, at times. Like, okay. So, what's happening, really, is, I mean, you have to get used to this, and sometimes this is a better way of going at emptiness, okay? This is a better way of going at emptiness. Because you're gonna hear tonight, if we ever get to the class, you're gonna hear that the difference between Mahayana presentation of emptiness and a Hinayana presentation of emptiness ain't a different emptiness. What is it? Rupa thaye begone. What's that mean? Rupa thaye begone. Yeah, a Mahayana person is hungry. They want to hear you explain it frontwards and backwards a thousand different ways, okay? They don't want to hear the panting over and over again, okay? Why? And then he said in the scripture, right? He said in the scripture last class, he said, you don't get enough karma for omniscience, okay? You don't get enough karma for omniscience by studying emptiness from one example. Not possible. You know? You can get enough karma for what? Nirvana, okay? You can stick to a few things. You can stick to a pen and an aspirin and, you know, an understanding of emptiness that will be strong enough to stop your anger, okay? That it won't be strong enough to trigger the perception of all things at all times. Omniscience itself, okay? For that, for the goals of an ambitious Dharma practitioner, meaning what? What's ambitious mean? Want to save everybody. Want to save every planet, you know? Want to save every country on this planet, and then let me go to some other planets, you know? So, I mean, you're ambitious, right? Dharma ambitious, right? So in that kind of person's mind, they need a stronger forms of emptiness to reach their goal. If you just don't want to be unhappy, you know, if you're just challenged by depression or by your anger or by your jealousy, well then okay, you just need the pen, alright? But if you are a real Mahayana person, which means you've got bigger goals in mind, you have a bigger vision, you know, you want to affect the world and then you want to affect many worlds, right? You're going after many worlds, okay? Then you gotta listen to this thing about how the clock picture rifles in your head. Because that's going at it from the back instead of at the front of the mind. Got it? Okay? When we talk about the pen, we're always talking about the thing that's already projected, right? And we're working backwards to prove it's a projection. But hey, how about if we work from the projection and work out to the clock? Okay, so what ripens in your mind just then? What ripens in your mind? How does the karmic seed ripen? You guys are falling asleep. I was on the flight for 24 hours. Now you guys are falling asleep. This is weird. You've been here. How does it ripen?
So,
how does the seed ripen?
The shapes and the colors on the wall evoke the clock on your mother's wall.
You can say that.
My association.
What do we call the thing that ripens? It's clock. Got it? That's very crucial. If you really want to see emptiness,
it's clock without the quotations. Right?
Well, clock without the quotations is clock. When I say clock, I mean clock. But when I say clock without quotations, it's the same thing. But I'm more talking about mentally. When you say this, clock, there's a danger that the person will mistake it for the word clock. Which we're not talking about. You know, C-L-O-C-K, those particular clicks and buzzes from your mouth are not clock. When we say clock, we mean... So this is a little dangerous to teach people, because then they think the sound is what you're talking about. You're not talking about the word clock. You're talking about the perfect clock in your mind. Okay? So, get this. When that clock ripens, When you look up right now at this moment, ready? When you look up right now at this moment, ready? And you see clock. You are watching clock in the back of your mind. You are not seeing the clock or a clock. Maybe there is no the clocks. Maybe there are no a clocks. Okay? You can't distinguish between this thing and the ideal. That's a false division. There are no the clocks, which are particular forms of clock. It's just clock. And
you say that's a clock?
No, you can't say that anymore, isn't it?
The one in your hand is not a clock?
Sorry?
The one in
this
your
is
hand?
Clock.
It's a clock. Because it's a clock on your computer that isn't that clock.
That's clock too when I look at it.
It is not the same clock.
No, they're not the same clock, but they're both clock.
Sure.
Okay? No, it's a good point. It's a necessary point, right? So, but now the big question is, I mean, you hear this. I was telling people somewhere on this last trip. I said, you know, I was kind of thinking at Princeton to study philosophy. And the religion and the philosophy departments were in the same building because they were the worst, they were the poorest two departments. They don't bring in any money from anywhere. So they get the worst building on campus and then they have to split it. You know, so it's one building that looks like a barn, and then they have to split it. You know, and then I walked over to the philosophy side one day, and I said, "I'm going to learn philosophy." You know, which would be they would be sitting here talking about this stuff, right? And then I sat there for like 20 minutes, and everyone was so confused, and everyone was so cluttered in their head, and they were just. What struck me immediately at 18 years of age was that it was all bullshit, you know, and they didn't ever intend to use it for anything. You see. So, and it never would happen, you know? And they would be over in that half of the, probably they'd have a third by now, I don't know. Okay? But how are we going to use it? You see? How are we going to be different from that? You know? How do we use this information? What do we want to use it about? Clock? How about irritating person? How about the last irritating person? The latest irritating person, okay, in your life, okay? Because one is replaced by another, right? You dump one and then the next one comes. You know, you can't escape them because they're coming from person, right? So then it affects me, you see? Then this idea affects me. If this person who irritates me and makes my life unhappy, makes my life uncomfortable, I would like to be happy all day, I'd like to be laughing, I'd like to be telling jokes all day, I'd like to be eating Mexican food all day. You know, like, this person's between me and my happiness, right? So, I want to find out where they come from, right? And how to change them, how to adjust them, right? So, if I understand the emptiness of that person, right? That they are not the clock, right? They are not the person. They are person. Which implies they are an idea. Which implies they are in my mind. Which implies they are coming from my mind. Which sooner or later implies that they were planted there by doing something similar. Right? All that backwards progression. Right? Then it can make me happy. I can reach happiness. I can eliminate my mental afflictions. I can reach nirvana. Right? Got it? I just explained to you how an understanding of emptiness can remove your negativities. Okay? Because you should have asked. Right? You should have asked. You're debating whether Hinayana people ever see emptiness. Because everyone agrees that Hinayana people do become arhats. They can become arhats, right? They can reach a state where they don't have any more anger. And everyone agrees that you can only do that by seeing emptiness directly. Right? Okay? But if you can't explain how we get from one to the other, then what's the purpose of discussing it, right? Whether they have the teachings or not. What's the purpose of discussing it? So, whenever this kind of debate comes up, can a Hinayana person remove their jealousy forever?
Yes.
So, that implies that they must be able to see emptiness directly. Yes. But what's the connection? How do you lose your jealousy forever just because you saw that emptiness? What happens? And now you know, okay, why. Last irritating person in your life. Latest irritating person, right? Then That's it. That's person and not a person. It's not the irritating person, and it's not an irritating person. It's irritating person, so-called irritating person. We say so-called in English, right? So you can, if I think Nagarjuna, I think Arya Nagarjuna, the beauty of Arya Nagarjuna, he spent his life in a, and the, and quotation marks, you know, the whole version of Mula Pragna, right? The whole root text on wisdom. The whole thing, the brilliance of Nagarjuna, is he never got into explaining stuff. He said, he's like, he would write a verse, right? He'd say, if he spoke English, right? He would be saying, think about a. Think about the. Thus ends the chapter on a and the. And, no, he wouldn't go on this 3-hour thing, you know? And it would be in poetry, right? It would be in poetry, right? There's some kind of brilliance to going to the basic thing. So, irritating person. Irritating person, as opposed to an irritating person and the irritating person. The last irritating person you ran into today was irritating person. And that was a picture in your mind. And that ripened. Then that's easier to see how that ripens, right, from a karma. It's not like the karma has to ripen in your head and they fall out of a tear duct and they grow. They suddenly grow in front of you and they fall off your head and there they are, you know. Because how could that happen? You know, and it's not that they just wander into your life randomly. You know, that life is a long string of, I almost said bad words, relating to arsis. Okay? I mean, either it's random and you're just, if the irritating people that you've ever met are the next person in the front of the queue, in an infinite line of irritating people waiting in some Truman's World dressing room, right? And they say, okay, we need irritating person number 75. Yeshla needs another irritating person here. And then the next actor comes out and says, if it were that irritating people were just wandering into your life at random, then life is hopeless. Then you could just do, my brother killed himself, you know? And I was like, why did you do that? You know, and then after a while, you're like, yeah. You know, if that's all there is, right? Just to me, irritating people until you die, then that's, you know, why not just get it over with, you know? And then, but if they are coming from a picture, if they are irritating person, that's ripening in my own mind, right? And if I can control that process, you see, I'm growing roses, right? Yafe. Like the iris, she gave me irises, right? To plant. So like, I didn't need irises. I was already busy. I had roses to plant. I had gardenias to plant. I had morning glories. I had histamines. I had globe, what do you call it? Mallows. I had all this stuff to plant. And she gives me a huge bag of irises, right? And she says, you gotta plant them in 3 days, you know, I'm like, pressure, you know, I got enough stuff to do. The garden's supposed to be relaxing, Joseph. And then, you know, I left them down in the storehouse, in the storeroom downstairs, and you know, it's a little kind of part of the storeroom, you know? I left them there. And then I conveniently forgot about that, you know? And then I go back like weeks later and here are these poor things, you know, and bugs have been chewing on them, and you know, so I said, well, she gave to me, I have an extra hour, I have to plant them, you know. So like I planted them, you know. And now they're growing. And the deer love them. Like they don't touch the other stuff. Just the irises, you know. The minute the flower comes out, like within 10 minutes there's a deer there. I don't know how they know. I think the birds tell them, you know, I think there's an iris going on there. And I think there's an iris coming. Then they come, you know. But this weird thing with irises is cool. Under the ground, they multiply. Like rabbits. You know? And they just keep splitting, and then new bulbs form from the old bulbs. And then then she gave me more work, because I have to dig them up regularly and divide them or else they kill each other because they can't feed. You know, they don't get their own dirt and water and, you know, oxygen, whatever they need. They're all clumped together. So like, you know, it's an extra job. So you have to dig them all up and then split the bulbs and then regrow them, right? So there's this similar thing happening in your mind, right? You meet one irritated person, you get irritated at them, and then you plant one iris bulb. And then in your mind, it just globes out, you know? It keeps splitting and multiplying and multiplying. And then there's like 25 bulbs underground ready to produce, each one ready to produce a new irritating person. No, sorry. Each one getting ready to produce
irritating
person. Okay, got it? And then if you understand that, then the whole life management becomes more of a real, of a possible thing to do, and not an impossible thing to do. You see? To manage all the irritating people in your life, who multiplying, if they were multiplying outside, you know, if they were just showing up on regular intervals in your life, and then you haven't stopped dealing with the last one yet, and now there's another one, you know, and then there's another one. And, you know, if life were all about managing the competing demands of 16 irritating people in your life, then it would be hopeless, right? But if life's all about a karmic seed, a new iris bulb in your mind, which is dividing and splitting, so long as you continue to be ignorant, so long as you continue to not understand emptiness, so long as you continue to not understand how the iris is splitting, it splits. Got it? The water which feeds it is the misunderstanding of what is happening. Got it? The reason it splits is that you don't understand it. And then that makes it split more. Got it? So then, that now, the name of the game becomes mental seed management. Right? Mental seed... what's the opposite of gardening? I don't know. Deforestation. Agent Orange. Mental Agent Orange.
Scorched
earth. We were in Vietnam, right? And they took us out to see what the Agent Orange did, you know? And that was bad. It's still there, you know? They said, we can't see the Viet Cong coming. So let's, instead of, you know, putting our boys at risk, let's just get rid of the jungle and make it a wasteland. And then you can see a guy walking. In our desert, you can see a guy walking because there's nothing else. You know, and they're like, well, let's just make it so nothing else can grow, and then we'll see the guys walking. You know, and we want to do a similar thing. Okay,
desertification.
We want to diamond mountainize all those balls. Okay, so now you have a sense of how an understanding of emptiness would A, prevent you from getting irritated, right? Because you can't. Because then you'd have to meet the person again, right? Like, you can say honestly to all the people who irritate you now, I'm not going to get irritated again. And they say, why not, Ernie? You know, it makes my day when you get all upset again. You know? And you say, well, because I don't like you. And Geshe-la said I can get rid of you. And they said, well, how do you suggest getting rid of me? And you say, well, he said if I didn't get irritated at you, you would have to leave. On your own. Without anything else. I don't have to fight with you. I don't have to argue with you. I don't have to reason with you. I just have to not be irritated at you. And you must go away. Even if you don't want to go away. Life will take you away from me. Okay? Like that. So that's on one side, that's how an understanding of emptiness can remove your anger, right? I can't afford to get angry at you. You deserve it. You're a stupid person, you're an irritating person, you're unreasonable, you've cheated me, you've lied to me, you've done all this stuff to me, right? Agreed. But I can't afford to get angry at you because I have to see you again. You know? So I'm gonna be nice to you and I'm gonna, you know, be reasonable with you even when you're not reasonable to me. Because I want to get rid of you. You know? I love you because I hate you. Again. Alright? Got it. Okay. And then just that thing about the irises can't multiply if you understand. The way you stop them from multiplying, and especially the way you stop them from sprouting, right, is that you understand them. Because the necessary nutrient that's feeding them And the nutrient which causes them to rise in the mind is misunderstanding. No, what allows them to pop out of the ground of your mind? How do they pop out of the ground of your mind? Clock. Just think clock. Okay?
Clock pops up
out of the ground of your mind. Right? And clock pops up. Irritating person pops up. Right? So they can't pop, even if you have the old seeds from the past, when you didn't know about this stuff, right? Even if you have seeds from the past, when you were trying to control yourself by conventional means, okay? Be nice to them because maybe they'll be nice to you. You know, be nice to them because it's going to raise your heart blood pressure if you don't. You know, be nice to them because it's a religious thing to do. You know, forget all that. You're going to use the real method. Be nice to them because you don't like them. And you don't want them to happen in your life. Okay, got it? So that's the connection between emptiness and... What's the emptiness, by the way?
Express the emptiness of this.
There is no dukkha. Right? Emptiness has to be something negative, right? It has to be the absence of something. There is no dukkha. There is no ekha. It's just clock. Everything is clock. Everything is perfect. Got it? Yeah.
Clock is unchanging.
Say again?
Clock is unchanging.
It is.
So
it is. It's impossible.
Everything can't be unchanging.
Yeah. What you're saying is that then you get into gata, okay? You want to get into gata. Gata means the thing that's not there. Right? The thing that's not there. What's happening now is you're believing in a clock that's out there, and maybe the numbers are changing, right? The numbers are changing on the clock. And
you mean numbers?
Numbers. They're changing on the clock. So that's a dukkha. They aren't changing on the clock. Okay.
So it's a
still
clock.
There's no dukkha clock, and the numbers aren't changing. So I think, in answer to your question, which is a good question, get a grasp on the gokcha. Where's the gokcha here? Where's the gokcha here? It's in my hand. The gokcha is not. There is no clock there. Okay? It's an image rather than your mind. And then you have to deal with the accompanying wrong ideas, okay? Or else you have broken bodhisattva vow, which is what? Teaching emptiness to a person who's not prepared. Or, you know, freaking people out with emptiness unnecessarily. Okay? So, you have to go on to say, and I did say in Hong Kong, right? Who is there? I did go on to say in Hong Kong, but that kind of talk is real. The one which is an unchanging club. Which is an unchanging club. That's real.
Well, they established
it can't be changing. The Garsman said if it had a quality, what did he say? In the opening lines of the 15th chapter, he said if it had some quality of its own, it couldn't change. If it didn't have a quality of its own, what could change?
That's a statement about the changing clock.
Well, that's what you asked about. He said it can't be unchanged. So we'll get there. We'll get there.
But it's a good...
What I'm saying, I'll put it this way. If you really want to see emptiness directly, and if your motivation is to save the world, which it is, then sometimes go at it from a different angle. Sometimes go at it from cheese. From what's happening when it ripens. Rather than pointing to a pen and saying, you know, look, two different people see the pen differently. Okay? Got that?
Work at it from where it's coming, popping out of the mind, rather than what's already there and discussing, you know, why two different people see it a different way. It's a different way to get at emptiness. It is actually relevant to our class, which we'll get back to, okay? We don't have refreshments, right? Like this poor guy's on a plane and dehydrated for 24 hours.
You do? Oh, that's so smart.
Okay. Okay. So first we start saying, I want to go back through what we did last time, okay? So we are going to refute the guy's rebuttal, okay? The guy came back, and now he gets to come back. Thank you.
He got an opportunity, which is, I think it's always so fair in the scriptures, with the Tsupapoma. He gets an opportunity to come back after we have argued against his position, right?
And he gets an opportunity to come back to defend himself, which is human nature, right? When someone has disproven something of your ideas, you always want to defend yourself, right? So Buddha Palita said that descriptions of how nothing in the universe has any self-nature are found in the sutras of the lower way. And it does mean that nothing in the universe occurs through any nature of its own.
What's that mean about clock? What's it mean about clock when I say it doesn't have a nature of its own?
That if it's changing, it's because my mind is changing. And it's not changing up there. Because clocks can move. They appear to
move. This is this thing of Nagarjuna where he took the clock, okay? He said, okay, look at the thing you think is the clock, right? Could it exist independent of the third of the kitchen clock? In your mind?
No.
Could an example of the clock exist independent of the clock in your mind that, you know, supposedly was planted there when your mom pointed to it when you were three?
No, it can't.
It cannot. Okay? So play with that as the meaning of it has no nature of its own. Play with that sometimes. I'm giving you a different way to play with it, okay? Play with that. Try to imagine a clock that could be a clock without clock as you learned it from your mom. Got it? Okay? Play with that. Play with that. Try to imagine clock. Try to imagine irritating person without a mental image of irritating person that you picked up somewhere. But which actually, according to the high school, is ripening in your own mind. Got it? So we're now distinguishing between her perfect clock coming from her mom, pointing to the clock on the wall when she was three. We're now distinguishing between that clock and clock as it has existed in your mind forever. Okay? We're not saying that your first image of a clock was planted by your mom pointing to the thing and saying that's where a clock is. We're saying it's older than that. We're saying it has no beginning. Okay? Because clock must come from a previous clock. From previous clock. There was never, how could you plant a seed for a clock, the latest clock? I like the word latest. Play with the word latest. Play with the and latest, okay? How could you plant a seed for latest clock if you hadn't given a clock? And when you gave the clock, having thought of it as a clock. Got it? If I don't understand what this is and I give it to you, how can it plant a seed for clock in the future? How can it plant a seed for coming clock in the future? But if I say I give it to you, I already have some image of clock in my mind, then where did that one come from? It came from giving a clock earlier, but I couldn't have given that clock earlier without having an image of clock in my mind. There is no first clock. Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Right.
You say yes. Okay, got it? In Buddhism, we say yes. Which came first, that clock or clock? But you can't have that clock unless you can comprehend clock. Or convex clock, right? You can't convex clock unless clock is ripening your mind. You can't get a karma from offering an object as a clock to ripen into an image of a clock unless you convex it as a clock. Otherwise, you'd get image for black thread or something. You know, you have a chunk of chewing tobacco or something. Okay, got it?
What about my mind?
Same.
Do you have perception of emptiness?
Yeah, somebody should ask that question. Who asked that question? Yeah, okay. So she's describing a unique event. She's describing a singularity event. Right? In a cone, what do they call it?
a causation cone, and then there's a singularity event. Meaning, what about something which happens for the first time? In your mind's existence, okay? So you've been living countless lifetimes. You've never had the direct perception of emptiness if you are who you seem to be. Okay, if you're still getting upset, or you're still having a rough life, or, you know, still junk happening in your life, then you haven't, then, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
It only happens once, right? It only, seeing emptiness directly for the first time only happens once in all of your lifetimes, in all of your infinite lifetimes, right? So, how can you cognize a new thing if you don't have any image of it from before? If no such thing has ever happened before to you, if you've never cognized thought, how can a clock ever come to you by ripening in your mind because you gave a clock cognizing what it was? Right? It's not possible. And I mean, this guy named Nimbo keeps asking me this question. So just to get out of it, I invented the answer of just so I could have a peaceful car ride. You can call it new conglomeration of stuff. New arrangement of old data. How's that? Or would you have to have a previous experience of a new arrangement of old data?
Was it like in the Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white to color?
Was it because it's a
is that
text metaphor?
Well, what I'm saying is that, well, you could say you could do it from, you could make the leap from metaphors, you mean? Or that's what you're saying. I mean, in logic, you make a leap from a metaphor. Right? You explain something that the person can relate to, and then they get something that is similar.
Well, like some kid in a movie who'd never seen a color movie before goes to see Wizard of Oz in 1939. It's an impression era baby. He's maybe the third movie he's ever been to. All he's seen is Laurel and Hardy, and then all of a sudden, Judy Garland's in Oz.
And he's got green slippers.
Right?
Right now, I'm tending towards the new conglomeration of old stuff. Of old mental images school.
Well, it's still Dorothy, but now she's in Technotronic.
But wait a minute.
Yeah, but how did she get into Technotronic?
Exactly.
But I think this is a new conglomeration.
Huh?
The
perception is.
She actually raised her hand.
Right.
How can there be a direct perception of emptiness, which is a direct perception of emptiness, which has always been, which is unchanging?
That's what she's asking.
Which is a seed, which is just never ripened.
And it's unproduced, so how can
you see it? No, you'd have to have something prior to it. You'd have to have someone else do it or something like that. Which means you'd have to cognize it that way.
Which means it would be dependent on another entity.
Maybe because it grows. Maybe because it grows, like you help it. You've heard explanations of emptiness forever. And I know from my personal experience, I've been doing it for quite a while.
So that's intellectual understanding, though. That's not emptiness.
No, but maybe it gets bigger and then. As it grows, the iris fades until it reaches a certain critical mass. I don't know. Right. Yeah. What do you think?
It's like we are one. So you get it from top at the end, but the oneness. It's kind of osmosis. Somebody who did it was somebody who did it.
Really?
So it's not by another.
What's impossible?
It is possible. If the mind keeps changing.
But what we're saying is that it never changes in a new way. Because for you to see a change, you must have changed, you must have helped someone change that way before.
You're saying that it cannot change in a new way?
That's what we're saying though. We never, you've seen clocks forever.
But then how do you get to be the angel?
Yeah, because you've never done it before.
You've never done it before.
That's what we're trying to figure out. I was hoping you were going to help us.
Well, I was thinking if the mind is always changing, it's possible.
Yeah. It's probably easier to see an angel than to see emptiness, because an angel is a compounded thing. And we're familiar with those.
Yeah.
Like conglomeration of stuff, I mean like the Madrachi of experience.
I mean new arrangements of old cheese. New arrangements of cheese which you already have. So I guess it's the same as what Mama Thomas said, because is you're dealing with mental images that you've always had, but someone shows you how to arrange them in a different format, in a different form.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, that's the process of logic, right? Supposedly.
It's a find the gotcha. You refine it until you've eliminated it. You can't eliminate it until you've found it, and you won't find it until you search it out and eliminate everything that isn't the gotcha. So it is a winner, in a way. You can't
I think it might be like that.
You can't see a this theory of establish the absence of the gotcha.
Alicia?
No way.
So your mother says there's this line and this other line because you have a mental image for a line, for line.
Yeah.
And there's a circle because you have a mental image for a circle. And then that's clock. And so that's what you're saying is that's like you can have a new you can have a new clock because you have a line and circle.
There's a digital clock,
too. Well, I guess the process, you can take the process of language itself, or the process of teaching someone a new idea, is that what I did today, what I did tonight, hopefully there were some ideas that you didn't have before. But in the process of logic, the classical process of logic, is to present three elements which the person already accepts, right? And they already accept the relationship between those three elements. And you're just showing them a new... It's like creating a new synapse between stuff that was already there. So, you know, you already knew what clock meant. You already knew what A meant. You already knew what the meant. You know, you already had some ideas about how stuff could come out of the mind. And then I just used words that you already knew and ideas that you already knew, and I sort of rearranged them, and then you got a new idea. So that's a... That's a possibility. We're discussing how can there be a singular event? How can something happen for the first time once?
Couldn't you say that about anything?
Yeah. Also that. It's like your direct perception of emptiness is still just like the chi. It's just you have a different experience of it.
But that different experience of it would be a chi in itself.
What if you rearrange your karmas?
not just using this heady idea of emptiness, but you're using it in a way that, like Ari said,
Maybe the intention is important. I don't know. Maybe you have a new intention or something.
It's not confidence.
So ignorance is a cause thing, right?
Yeah.
And if ignorance is a cause thing, and whenever ignorance arises in the mind, it's coming from some cause.
Yeah.
Is it possible for there to be a state of mind following an ignorant state of mind that does not contain ignorance?
That's the claim. I mean, that's the claim. There's a section in Abhidharma that divides stuff into like ignorance and goodness and evil and purity, and then it gives all the possible permutations. Can a virtuous state of mind follow a non-virtuous state of mind? Can a virtuous state of mind and desire realm trigger a virtuous state of mind in the formless realm? Can a perception of deceptive reality immediately precede a perception of ultimate reality? That's why they discuss it in that. They get into that.
So then
they decide that you can.
Yeah.
The question is, what can provide an immediately preceding state of mind to these higher states of mind? You know, what is the immediately preceding state of mind to direct perception emptiness? You can say Jorwan Chichok, right? You can say that the understanding of the teapot that you got just before you went into the direct perception of emptiness, right? So how would you characterize that? It's not an unstained state of mind in Abhidharma terms, but it's close. It's the closest you ever got, right? It is a powerful understanding of what we talked about tonight. That's Jorwan Chichok. It's a powerful, direct understanding of what we've been talking about tonight. And that's why we're talking about it, by the way. Because I would like you to get into Jorwan. And I'd like you to see emptiness there. If I had to choose a 1.5-hour talk that would trigger it most likely, that would most likely trigger it, this would be the one. That would be the one.
So is the first moment of Tomlong the first moment that there is no ignorance in your mind?
In Abhidharma terms, you would say, yeah. Sakme lami dambatam dumachinam sunyam te namkatami gopani denam nakam rindako o. Opening lines of the Abhidharma question. Sakme lami dambatam dumachinam sunyam te. The only changing thing which is pure is the direct perception of emptiness. You know, in Abhidharma terms.
And it's changing because it arises and emerges and ceases. That's what you mean by changing.
Yeah.
The perception, not the emptiness.
The perception. Yeah. That is it. Maybe, now, Chris, you're being stalled, or you want to get home early tonight? Or which would you prefer?
Are you tired?
No, I'm not tired. But just what's good for you? Okay, how about I do another 10 minutes? Okay. Let me do a little bit of the class, because you might want your money back if I... I get these emails like once a year, of course, only once a year. Somebody complaining bitterly about me, and then I sit down to breakfast, and I'm like, but all I'm doing is giving 7 years of free classes. You know? I don't understand. Okay, anyway, maybe the jokes aren't good enough. So Master Buddha Palita did say that you can find in the Hinayana Sutras explanations of how nothing in the universe has any nature of its own. And then Master Baba Viveka, who is the bad guy, because he's the lower middle school. If you want one person who is the classical representative of the lower middleway school, this is Master Baba Viveka. He wrote a 2-volume presentation on emptiness in the lower middleway school, and that's the classic. And it's in the Tengyur, it's 2,000 pages, right? And it's good, okay? So he says, well, I suppose Lord Buddha didn't have to teach Mahayana, because Hinayana already had a good explanation of emptiness in it. Okay, got it? We said that already. So we say to Master Baba Viveka, you're contradicting scripture and you're contradicting common sense, logic. Okay, how does he
contradicting scripture. We already gave a lot of sutras that said, where Lord Buddha said that lower people can see emptiness directly, and they have emptiness in their, in the scriptures. They say they had emptiness in the scriptures. Okay, got it? Now here's how Master Bhavaviveka's position contradicts logic. Then we split the debate. Okay, there's called a split answer. You say, are you saying that if emptiness was clearly explained in the lower school scriptures, the whole Mahayana was unnecessary? Or are you saying just the teaching on emptiness in the Mahayana were unnecessary? Okay? That's what we're asking here. Then, either way he goes, you split a question so you can squash the guy on both hands. That's the method. You know, you give them two bad choices, and then you're hoping they'll take one or the other. If they fall for the idea of taking a choice, then you already got them, okay? Would you like a yellow diamond or one with a black spot? You know, and then let their mind go on that. If you say the Mahayana was unnecessary because the Hinayana, the whole Mahayana is unnecessary because the Hinayana has a good explanation of emptiness, okay? Then you're wrong because it's not just the teachings on emptiness which distinguish the scriptures of the greater way. They also present the bodhisattva levels, and they present the six perfections, and they present Manlam and Ngor, okay, which are high bodhisattva practices. You know, I do. Lama Krishna used to sit in LA somewhere and feed birds little pieces of French fries and do a Manlam, you know, like, you're going to be my student 16 lives from now. If you, you know, you see this little guy with a black head and a brown beard, and he's like hanging out over there, and he's a little scared, and you break off this tiny, tiny little piece, you know, and you flick it over to him. And as it's going to the air, you say, okay, Buster, if you eat it, you're going to be my student in 10 lifetimes, you know. And then you're like watching. And then he would chomp, and then we'd go, like that. So that's Manlam, or those are Ngor. These are high bodhisattva practices. You don't find them in Hinayana, okay? They would think that was dumb or something, okay? What ultimately is the karma that produces in the mind of a high Hinayana practitioner, or even a high Mahayana practitioner? Why is it that they wake up in the final moments and go a little farther and get enlightened, right? Remember that story? They're like stuck in a lower nirvana. Like, what is it that kicks them out and pushes them higher? And then there's all these stories about the Buddhists coming in and tapping him on the shoulder and saying, hey, man, you know, I know you're having a really good time, but... yeah, it's like somebody's really high and you're like knocking them on the shoulder, hey, man, I know you're having a really good time, but, you know, we got some beer in here also. So anyway, tapping him, who taps him on the shoulder? It's Manlam, okay? It's the little sparrow feedings of McDonald's French fries that you did all those years. It's all the momentary feelings of intention that I would like to save your life, you know? And then you're just chilled, and you're on a track to stay chilled indefinitely, and then one of those little boogers ripens. One of those little French fry boogers ripens, you know? And then that's the tap on the shoulder. Got it? Okay, yeah.
So it's your Manlam or someone else's?
It's your Manlam.
So you make these aspirations to help others, and that ripens this corner.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Then he quotes Aryanagarjuna to say that's what characterizes the Mahayana. Okay? Then he says, okay, suppose you say that, and then we'll finish, okay? We'll just finish up with that. But we'll just catch up to where we were, okay? Suppose you say that, okay, the whole Mahayana was okay. I think the Mahayana in general was cool. You got those perfection things, you got the Manlam thing, you got the dedication thing. It's pretty cool. But definitely the teachings on emptiness, the subtle forms of emptiness, found in the Mahayana are redundant. If Lord Buddha taught all the forms of emptiness, if he taught emptiness fully already in the lower school, not necessary in the Mahayana. Okay? I'm not saying you don't need the whole Mahayana, but you definitely don't need those teachings on Sama emptiness because Lord Buddha already covered that. Okay? So he says to Baba Viveka, if you do say that, literally infinite number of different proofs of emptiness. Rigpataye begone. People who are shooting for the big time, they need lots of different explanations of emptiness. Why? Why did we say? Why do they need it? You would want to say, oh, they're more talented, they can take more explanations, they will get it faster if they hear a lot of explanations. That's what you feel like saying, right? But what does the scripture say? Why do they need infinite proofs of emptiness? Are they stupider?
Because there's infinite beings and they're all going to have to have a tailor-made presentation, right?
Yeah, it's more like that. It's more like, and then he's going to say, they need infinite karma. They need to push themselves into omniscience instead of just nirvana. It takes a lot more good karma. And every time you think about emptiness, you make more good karma. So if you have infinite arguments for emptiness, if you go to infinite classes about emptiness and they say, and they take different approaches in each class, then you've got more good karma to go into omniscience rather than just nirvana. Nirvana you can do on the pen. To become omniscient, that's a different ballgame. You need higher caliber karma. Got it? That's what he's going to say next, I think. Yeah, here you go. They just want to get to freedom, meaning nirvana. So they could use an abbreviated presentation. Okay? And then he quotes a couple books to prove that. This is interesting. Emptiness is not presented in infinite forms in the Mahayana, but it is presented
fully.
Okay?
Fully. In the lesser way. No.
There's, yeah, in the lesser way, it's not presented in infinite formats, but the few presentations there are complete. So you can't say that the way the Mahayana differs from the Hinayana is that the Mahayana is somehow more complete. It's just more variations. Got it? There are one or two explanations of emptiness. The pen thing is complete. The clock thing gives you more variations. Got it? Okay. By the way, he's also saying, look, you can't do the lack of self to a person and lack of self to things division. Okay? That lower way somehow doesn't have one or the other. Okay? Maybe. And that brings us to our class. Okay? So we're at new material now. Okay? This starting here, I'll make some lines. So you're caught up. Now you can go on. Alright?
And
okay? We'll be starting from there. Alright? Basically they've proven that emptiness is presented fully in the lower school. Okay? And that the difference between the presentations is not the content of the presentation, it's the variety of the presentation. Got it? Okay? Because they need more good karma because they got bigger stuff in mind, bigger goals in mind. Alright? They want to go to many countries and what Michael said. They need big toolboxes. Got it? And to have a big toolbox is already a good karma. More good karma. The intention to have a big toolbox is already a bigger karma. Got it? The intention to know different ways of proving emptiness so that you can help more people later is already a bigger karma. Even if you don't understand all this presentation of emptiness. Got it? The intention to try to learn them so you can be more helpful to people. Somebody in Vienna shows up and, you know, you're out there under the sun on the balcony and they're like, I don't understand this. Can you explain it again? The French lady, were you there? Yoram was there. The French lady was, it was so cool, you know, here's Yoram. By the way, you really trained these guys well. I mean, that was so, they were so sharp. Only the Israelis. But they were so well trained. And then, you know, this lady saying, yeah, but I was at the ticket counter, and, you know, I went to get this government form filled out for my school, and the lady just didn't understand me. So I should have gotten angry, you know? I mean, if you guys don't understand, I was dealing with a different person than you are. You know? I was dealing with someone really irritating and really unreasonable. And she truly believed that the person she had run into was different than the people we had run into at the government office, you know? And then Yoram was so skillful in doing the emptiness of the lady at the office, you know? And it was really beautiful. Okay, but he did it because he had different... She didn't get the first three proofs, and then he kept going at her with different ones, you know? In a very, very gentle way, because he's not... He's like the most gentle person you can meet, right? He said, yes, but maybe you could think. You know, and then, you know, you have one French lady whose English nobody can understand, and then you got the oh, speaks like that. And then they're trying to talk to each other. You know, and it's so cute. Because she's like, what? And then she's like, what? And, but it worked. On the fourth try, on the fourth variety of emptiness, she was like, oh, she's coming from me, you know? And it was so beautiful to see, you know, two people from completely different cultures speaking almost not a common language. And then she got it because of his training. So really, you did a good job. They were stars, superstars. Okay, let's do a mandala. I apologize for both, Jim, that I ran over a little bit.